Well, tonight, I personally am very pleased to announce that we have John Tyner here to speak to us about the history of Aloha. John and I have known each other for many, many years. I'm a retired lawyer, so that means I'm smarter than he is. I think he's still actively practicing, he has come to us and talked to us about the history of Aloha. So I think he'll be able to make a very fine presentation, an interesting presentation, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say. John, why don't you come on up here?
Thank you.
You know it.
Richard leaves this area to move back, the average IQ will decline.
Well, maybe I should hang around. John, how long have you been here in Beard?
I was born at St. Vincent's Hospital.
Okay.
And so basically a couple sojourns away for a brief period of time. As you remember, in 1958, the legislature required that the employees of the Attorney General's office move to Salem for a brief period of time.
Okay.
Well, I actually didn't think it was going to be a brief period of time. I thought it was going to be a long time.
Yeah.
But then they relented, and my dad moved back.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So John's father is also an attorney here in town. Mm-hmm. Now, do you practice here in Beaverton, or?
I my office is in Hillsboro. I practice all actually over the state.
Okay. Well, John Tyner, I gave him enough advertising, so now he can.
How much time do I have, Richard?
2 minutes.
You have as much time as you need until the people start standing up and walking out.
What time does this meeting usually end?
8:30,
9:00. Yeah. Okay, so why don't you take a half an hour if you have at least that time, that amount of time. If you need more, that's fine.
Let's find out what we share in common as far as knowledge of Oregon just generally. And I want some input, too. You guys disagree, or I don't want to turn into a baiting session, but if you disagree on certain things that are held to be common knowledge. Anybody know the tribe of Indians that just generally lived in this area? Okay, and what general overgroup of tribe are they part of?
Calipoya.
Okay. What happened in about 30 or 40 years before Moose and Clark actually came to this area? What catastrophe affected the Indians?
They were essentially
depopulation. And the Klickitats used to come over the Columbia River and basically take slaves in this area. By the time the first settlers arrived here, the tribes were, in essence, depopulated. And by about the 1840s, 1850s, essentially, they were beggars, calling on the settlers for such as their work for food. And what major, if anybody has an opinion, what major thing affects this general area every 300, 350 years?
Tsunami?
Yeah, tsunami subduction area, this is the zone. And the reason you don't find long-term civilizations, that at least is postulated along the west coast, is that everything washes away, periodically. You go back 10,000 years, you're still talking about the last of the ice age, the ice sheets, and of course the alluvial plains that took several thousand years to develop before you even had soil that was able to even grow the trees that you see now. So when you go out, you say it's amazing these forests have been here forever. Well, actually, they haven't, because the lifespan of a dug fir forest is about 900 years on average. So essentially, what the Indians did here is the theory is that if the land, they came down the land bridge, they either came walking, or the newest theory is they came down by boat along the land bridge. And some of these areas are kind of spread out. And people really don't actually know the actual genetic characteristics of the original settlers here. And help me, who really knows? Remember Kennewick Man? What was Kennewick Man determined to be genetically? Anybody remember?
10,000.
Kennewick Man was determined not to be Native American.
Exactly. Resident here 10,000 years ago.
Yes.
I'll start with the right, I'm sure you kind of have a question, because actually I think Richard knows all that stuff. But I want to find out where we're at, because one of the things that the Indians did in this area, I'm going to get to Aloha just in a second, but one of the things the Indians did in this area was they didn't like dug fir forests. And anybody know why they didn't like dug fir forests?
Hunting. For hunting?
For farming. Did they flash and burn and all that sort of thing?
They did, but because Douglas fir forest is a desert. Things can't live in there. It's like if you go down to the jungles of South America, basically when you're everything's housed up in a canopy, but the lower level's easy to move through because there's no jungle there because there's no light. And so basically, Tualatin Valley is a prime example of slash and burn agriculture. Not in the sense that they were agriculture folks, in the sense of cultivating land like the Indians around Boston did, because when the pilgrims came, they came in contact with agricultural community. So essentially, they didn't have the same type of agricultural communities here. And where did the Calipuya Indians go in the when things were tough in the winter? Where did they set up their lodges? They actually went up in the winter, summers, but they went up at Gaston around Wapato Lake. So you had this transit thing, you had their old trails. So when it came here, when the settlers came here, there wasn't much here. There was no, they didn't have to evict the Indians particularly. And Aloha in particular was not, it was a plains because the Tualatin Plains extended all the way out because periodically they burned it. The Indian women actually had this, after the burning, they went and harvested some of the things with some of the plants when they were charcoal and used that to make food. But I'm not going to stay here. The most interesting part, as my point is now. Not that almost nothing happened back then was interesting. this is history. This is history. This is not the history I want to talk about. Because big picture, ship captains come around from Massachusetts. My family's from Massachusetts. We didn't come with the ship captains, as a matter of fact. They came about the time ship captains were leaving because they run out of potatoes in Ireland. But the same, the culture of Portland had more in common with Boston than perhaps any other place. The settlers in this area, the later settlers, and I'm going to be talking about the settlers from the 40s, 1940s, had more in common with Appalachia. A lot of the folks came up to work in the shipyards, Kaiser shipyards. Mm-hmm. And after their, matter of fact, my wife's family actually got here through Joe Higgins, who was a black sharecropper from Five Points, Alabama, basically the Higgins plantation. He came up here because he wanted to break loose, you know, so he came up and was working in the shipyards, and he later settled in Vancouver. My dad came over because he was a Catholic Democrat from Boston, and the Republicans had old law firms, the lodges, the Dodges, etc. So if you're going to be a lawyer out of Boston College, because the Protestants went to Harvard and Yale, the Catholics created their own college because they couldn't get in there, called Boston College. So Boston College is going to be the Harvard of the West Coast. So my dad, that was an incredible pretension because it was essentially a streetcar college. Now it's a much better university. My dad was told at the reunion he would never have been admitted on the current standards. But the point is, everybody here came from someplace else, but not much happened prior to the 40s. In fact, in the Great Depression, this area of Oregon especially wasn't even particularly affected by the Depression much because it's so separated from the general commerce. Anybody object? Anybody contest that?
My parents were born in Orenco. Mm-hmm. In 1916 and 1921, mm-hmm. and the biggest nursery mm-hmm. was in Orenco, and if
the Oregon Company,
yes, and that's how Orenco became named, but it went under.
But basically it was pretty much agricultural mm-hmm. with timber, some mining out in the mm-hmm. southeast, but. We didn't suffer the bread lines, we didn't have those type of things in Oregon of a significant nature that we had other places. There were not major food lines in Portland and suicides.
There was still a lot of people out of work, though.
For people out of work.
They worked up at Timberline.
Right, the CCC built Timberline, Cornell, mm-hmm. built a lot of those projects, but we did not see the same impact mm-hmm. on Oregon that you had other places. And the reason was, and the point of what I said that, was it's so divorced from the national economy. So, the first settlements that occurred, you know, if you go out by Harvey Marine and you see the Reedville Cafe, you see those trees there? Mm-hmm. If you've eaten at the shack, you can go in, and those are actually Simon, the lad, Sergeant Ladd, and I have to look at my notes, I guess, now. The other sea captain, Prodigy. Prodigy, I should say. Anyways,
basically, that's just related to Jenkins.
No, Jenkins is different. Jenkins was a businessman who had a place out there in
pharmacy. Simeon Reed.
Yeah.
His name was Reed. Simeon Reed.
Reed came across, Lance came across, Jenkins came across. Everybody had money, and Frank Jenkins kept that out there because that was outside of that old sort of landed gentry thing that the folks in New England adopted from the English. Mm-hmm. You had your place in, and then you had your country place.
Right.
And so that was Jenkins' equivalent country place. So Simeon Reed sat there. There's also, interestingly enough, you know the Willamette Stone Park is where the Nation Land Claims, where the whole area is organized. It's broken up according to townships and sections located from right there. And all of you probably remember from this little thing right here, that one of the everybody ever seen this before?
No.
Yeah. We do have copies of that here.
Okay. In 1968, on the 75th anniversary of Beaverton, they put out this nice little pack publication here. It's really very good because it tells about everything. It talks about Augustus Spano, the earliest settler in Beaverton. It talks about Denny and Betts and all those folks and settling here. You know, they take care of the beaver ponds. And they talk about all those things. Is that background part of your shared knowledge here right now? Mm-hmm. Draining of the beaver ponds, mm-hmm. The conflict between the railroads, Gaston and Cornelius, Colonel Cornelius and Gaston, and the present location of those things. Has everybody been printing all that stuff? Okay, well, how about the Oregon Electric Railroad and things like that? Mm-hmm. So out in Alloa, essentially, is not even really mentioned because there wasn't anything to mention. It's really, you've got Simeon Reed's and William Sergeant Ladd's thing out there. You've got the Wheeler Donation Land Claim. And we just had the centennial on January 8th of the Alloa Post Office. Did anybody go to that?
No.
Okay. Well, basically, what that was the sort of problematic in the sense that when the post office was named, we don't even know why it's named that, but in 1983, an individual came back and said that basically the Buck version is that the first Julius Buck was living in King City in 1983 when he heard that there Alloa was going to incorporate. Remember that's where we're getting the substance of my talk now about their most recent history. And he came back and said Alloa really came from the name of dinner, where actually came from a town of Wisconsin. There actually isn't a place in Wisconsin named Alloa-E. And they're basically the other version is by a lawyer from the neighborhood named Capples. And the station was, there was a station at Wheeler Crossing, which is about where 185th and DB Highway is now. And they came up with the idea that basically she was singing a song, his daughter was singing a favorite song named Alloa Oe. And she just returned from Hawaii, and people said, oh, that's Alloa. No one knows where Alloa came from. Got 1983 in King City, came forward at the time of the Alloa Incorporation to say that that's where it came from. Not really important, because that's still called Alloa. There was nothing there, literally. Until 1955, there was TV Highway was two lanes, and I don't really remember that too well, because I was born until 54. But I do remember Farmington Road had no shoulder at all. That was actually kind of dangerous to travel. But the shack was, I think, 1934, 1935 when it started. You had the Hazeldale store, you had Cook's Market, and you had farming. But you also had something kind of interesting. You had one of the major figures in the community, and I actually have him in here as a baby. My dad's law partner, Al Kemmer, and everybody knows where Kemmer Road is, and Cooper Mountain. Well, I have a picture, if I can find it, of him as a baby in 1899 up on the top of Cooper Mountain being held in swaddling clothes by his mother's. And the Roosers were there. The Riggers were there. Yeah. Well, I used to work up there. I used to he owned the northern part of Upper Mountain was actually the Kemmer Ranch.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
It was
I grew up up there.
Yeah, basically it was very beautiful. It was kind of interesting how it stopped being the Kemmer Ranch and became Kemmer Estates. You know,
that's right.
Basically, he never wanted that to happen. He was on my dad to do his will all the time. My dad never did, and so basically, there was not a very good transference of title, and so they merged the life estate, the remainder interest, sold it off to an incredibly, I think, large and powerful company, whose economic end no one could have predicted, Edwards and Company. Who collapsed, was it, 83?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, I don't see that here, but that's not what I really want to talk about. what I really want to talk about...
How long were his parents up on the hill?
Well, basically, the reason they were up on the hill is because nobody else wanted it. Basically, the lower areas were the nation land claims. There was a bunch of them. And the reason I know that is because after I graduated from college, I still wanted to be on the Olympic wrestling team. So I decided to take 2 years off before I went to law school. You don't never heard of my name in wrestling, have you?
No, John.
That's why I went to law school, because it didn't work out so dang well. It didn't work out so dang well. But during that period of time, I worked at a title company, and a young representative named Mike Ragsdale, who's a principal in Markham Investment, used to come in all the time. And because they couldn't think of anything better to do with me, because they knew I was just passing through, they had to get a locator. They had me as a locator. And what I was supposed to do is locate property. And I don't know how many people can see this map, but at least see 26, Highway 26. Do you see how everybody knows where Highway 26 is?
Yeah.
And there's three young guys in Markham Investment, but the political figure was Mike Ragsdale. And Mike, all he wanted was property along Sunset Highway. And this is about 78, 79. I couldn't figure out why they always wanted property up around there. And it was all farmers, guys like Jones, you know.
Fish bags.
Fish, the people you'd never really heard of. We're not hear their names again. But my dad, coincidentally, was one of the first hearings officer for LCDC. And a friend of ours, Greg Hathaway, was a county attorney. And Aloha, I'm going to tie this together for Aloha in just a second. Aloha was generally considered almost anything from Shoals Ferry all the way up north of the highway. Primarily agricultural, Jannigans, a whole bunch of folks had farms in this area. And essentially, it really hadn't been worked with a bucket of warm spit prior to the 40s. After the interstate highway system was built, people started coming out, and a real development started. ESI, folks like that, you know, the Tektronix, and you know, Tektronix had a little thing they did for aircraft. Anybody know where that was?
Radar. But
not radar. They did a whole measuring thing.
Yes.
There we go. And what were they using for during World War II? Doesn't matter. they settled here, By about 1977, there were 24,000 people worked for Tektronix. ESI was up in Science Park. They had all these developing things. And Lowell was from here to here. But Washington County was obdurate. They would not adopt a comprehensive plan. And people were going, the rest of the state are going, the state required out of the Trump and McCall administration and the offices of some folks who were representatives from this area, planning. They decided that the whole state of Oregon would be planned. They would utilize soils and land in a certain manner. And every state unit of government, county, was required to develop a plan. The comprehensive plan had to meet certain criteria. Washington County refused to draw a comprehensive plan. They just refused to do it. A person we both know, Lester Coyne, who had been worked in the public relations department at Pacific prior to running for office, just kept pushing it. Nobody could figure out why. There's a guy named Wayne Atterbury. He's an executive in an insurance company called Standard Insurance. And Standard Insurance was out there, but, you know, the whole idea of development of macro types of thing had come after World War II. In New York, we had Levittown, but here, kind of a visionary company named Equitable. Equitable basically started developing up in Cedar Hills. This flats up there, all those things like that. And basically, these are small houses. I think they were selling for $7,500 to $15,000, first class, mini plats. Cedar Hills has its own sense of government and things like that. And Roger Meyer was their attorney forever. And the function is a little city. But the idea of a financial entity, Equitable Savings and Loan, for example, financing and development, was not new. In fact, Lake Oswego had the same kind of development. But Standard Insurance is out there, but nobody knows really what they're doing. Nobody knows what Market Development's doing. And I don't know what Rexville's doing, but they're all the time there. And every time they're there, the president of the company, the head of the company locally, amongst McGurr, made sure that I showed them every courtesy of the PNDI title plan. So I go to law school, and I come back, we have the Sunset Corridor, and Washington County adopts a comprehensive plan. So essentially what happened was, for that period of time, North Aloha was some of the land up here. Mm-hmm. Beaverton Hills though were kind of, Beaverton was kind of over here, those were over here, but a very aggressive city manager for Hillsborough named Eldon Mills extended as far as he could the Hillsborough plan. And all those farmers were negotiating with investment real estate groups like Mark Investment, and land really wasn't nothing, really worth nothing, not much at all. And there was a crisis nationwide at that point on land values. Basically, people were concerned over the whole country about foreign acquisition of land, because land was just, farmland was so dirt cheap. So these folks went out and they optioned all those land. Once they had it all there, they turned it, set up the Corridor Association, and began essentially redefining the county and the state. That became the focus of high-tech development. But what it did is, all of a sudden, Lower became defined as the area south of that. Mm-hmm. You know, and a few people like Carl George and some other folks were saying, well, for crying out loud, you know, we're starting to see some population in these areas here. Maybe we should form a city. So there was a thing called the Boundary Commission at that time. They took their arguments to the Boundary Commission, and these folks were just political amateurs. They were volunteers of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. They came on there, and they said, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we threw a party and had a city? Other people had plans for that land. Big plans, you know? So essentially, Aloha has slowly, as Beaverton has edged to 165th, this is actually roughly, I think, the city limits of Beaverton in 1970. Not much beyond that, and that's probably 145th, which we now call Murray Road. And Tektronix, of course, has never been in the city because they had the power not to be. But you pretty much didn't go too much further than here. And Terra Linda, of course, wasn't even part of the city.
Do you know what the population was back in 1970?
Yeah, I do, because that's about the time Hillsborough started getting mad at Beaverton.
Yeah.
That's when Hillsborough got bigger than Hillsborough. They're about, both are about 12,000.
Really? Was that a lot?
I think maybe a little lower than that. It was 8,000. What happened is, after 1965, something happened in 1965, 64, over in Asia. I don't know if anybody can remember that. Well, a lot of Beaverton folks, were supplying the war effort, you know, and the population started coming over here. So by 68, I think the number was 12,300 in Hillsborough, 12,600 in Beaverton. Hillsborough is very upset about that. And they said about the expansion that's continued to this day in sort of a competitive manner with Beaverton. They always thought they were smarter than Beaverton, because they were older than Beaverton, and not as landlocked as Beaverton became. But anyway, so what happened, the story of Aloha is pastoral farmland, basically. Farmers out there doing their thing. You got the Bucks at the post office. You got the Wheelers. You got Simeon Reed and his folks in the past century, in about the 1987 thereabouts. You got the Nation Land Claim Act, that's 1866, And Oregon had a little, because Abraham actually Lincoln actually liked this. It's kind of interesting you brought up Baker's name. He actually liked this a lot. We actually had a land claim statue specifically for us as a reward for not coming in as a slave state. So basically before the National Act in 1866, if you correct me if I'm wrong, when the rest of God, we got one. We had one ongoing. So although it's kind of shrinking a little bit now, because they're going this way. So what you have now is Alloa defined by what it's not. It's not Hillsborough, it's not Beaverton. And you actually have Alloa, 41,000 people, generally from the area of that's Cornell right there, let's see, baseline through here. Basically that's a, let's use this little area right here, Gassner, back up over here, 209th, and back up, and 41,000 people generally in that area. But because TV highways have expanded to such an extent, the community has again bifurcated north and south, even by school district. Century High School, which is the northern part, this is a part of Alloa, north of TV Highway, is actually Hillsborough School District. South and some north is Alloa. It used to be, at one time, you had Beaverton High School, which predated the Hillsborough. And Beaverton had this immense thing. People on Bonnie Slope went to Beaverton High School. This whole large area, then you had Hillsborough. And when Al Kemmer, going back to Al Kemmer, when Al Kemmer was living up on Cooper Mountain, basically, he really thought of himself as being in Beaverton. He was actually captain of the first Beaverton football team, which I think played in 1913. I think you can see that photo. There's some photo like that at the usually Beaches restaurant, Ruby Red.
Oh, Ruby Tuesdays.
Ruby Tuesdays, yeah. You can actually see that. But the actual picture of him as a football captain in 1913, I saw it in his office when I was there. And I spent a lot of my time since I worked there up there for Bailing Hayes and Hickenberry. See, the kids from very young, from the time that your kids, your parents could kick you out of the house at 5 or 6 in the morning and figure you could make it to a school bus and ride out to a berry field to work with winos, drunks, and other folks. basically, you could get yourself out. You're right, we used to call them bums, didn't we? I'm sorry about that. But hobos. And they actually had separate buses. They didn't mix the buses. The local buses just cruised right down Burnside, headed right up over the hill, and came back down in. Or Farmington Gardens there was a place where we picked. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, Al Kemmer actually was a very fervent Catholic, and he actually worked for free for the Sisters of St. Mary's for years. He actually gave the tract of land which Tektronix sits up there, that was formerly Sisters of St. Mary property, because remember the Sisters of St. Mary's at Murray and TV Highway? They actually owned it all the way up.
Oh, wow.
And one of the great religious liberty cases comes out of the Sisters of St. Mary's and Beaverton's Pierce versus the Sisters of St. Mary's, which brings to my next thing about your life, about living in this area, especially in Alloa. The Klan, Pierce was one of the first Democratic governors in the modern era, and he was gained to office with Klan support. And the Klan support, to a certain extent, came out of Washington County. Democrats, such as they were, you know, here were, you know, some of the Southerners who were settled here earlier. And basically, St. Cecilia's had a church and a little school, religious school. Mm-hmm. And by initiative, supported by the Klan, Governor Pierce, they were going to ban religious education. They wanted everybody to be in the public schools. Mm-hmm. And it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And one of the great religious liberties is the Pierce versus the Sisters of St. Mary's, because the Supreme Court said that basically under the First Amendment, you had a right to practice religion, you had a right to teach your kids that religion, if you had a right to teach your kids religion, you had a right to do it in schools, as long as there was no tax money attached to it. And so that's one of the interesting constitutional law cases that came out of Oregon in this area. And I bring that up to talk about the sisters who were very much embattled as Catholics, you know, because, again, the Klan didn't like Catholics. And later, the resettlement after World War II, when the folks came out of Antwerp, something bad happened to Vanport at some point in time. People had to just dissipate to various places. And that actually, for blacks, they were redlined in Oregon. It's actually against the Board of Realtors' ethics to sell to blacks outside of what's denominated Albina today. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going anyplace. They went from Vanport right to Albina. But the other folks decamped to Mount Hood, to Cooper Mountain.
Yep.
Cooper Mountain. I don't know if you've been through there, but we used to call them haulers. Mm-hmm. Basically, used to be lots of little haulers, which are now high expensive homes on those little roads back there. And when I was in high school, nobody would admit to being from Cooper Mountain. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get a kid to admit to being from Cooper Mountain.
Really?
Yeah. See, it changed when you were at Loa. When you were at Loa, they figured out how to do a sewage filtration system that allows some of the houses to be built up there.
That's why they all partied up there. It used to be the woods. It's cleared now since Metro bought it.
Right on top, and right there.
Yeah, that's where my grandparents, that big long house, that was they built it.
Yeah, I remember that very well, as a matter of fact. And basically, you remember a little outbuilding at the Jenkins Estate, which used to go to in Loa.
Yeah, well, I used to ride my horses through there.
Yeah, me too.
And the high school kids used to party like heck on that little greenhouse that you see as you come around the way.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't speak from personal knowledge. I wouldn't do that. But anyway, so anyway, you have a situation where when I used to do chores in Beaverton, and things like that, people say, that's mighty whitey, give you a buck.
Yeah.
You know, or men, you know. Or if you acted badly, you guys say, act like a white man, you know, things like that. And basically there's a heavy current of racism endemic in this area, especially in some of the rural farming communities. You have Jacktown, you have Hazeldale, you got all the way out to Midway. And basically in the 40s and 50s, you had the TYV Lake, the Fulton Valley Lake, and you're looking more towards Newburg and Hillsboro and McMinnville than you were Portland. He was talking about going over the hill to Portland.
Yeah.
Basically, we're sort of self-contained out here, but the expansion of the Sunset Highway from the old Wolf Creek, you know, made Portland more accessible. But Aloha, after the Sunset Corridor, has now shrunk because you now it's unincorporated. And of course, everybody remembers the county didn't even have a tax base. Prior to the tax base I got in mid-80s, trivia question, who remembers the prior tax base? 1916. Mm-hmm. So essentially, they did a succession of levies to support the county, which meant if you were in an unincorporated area, you didn't get much, because there wasn't much to get. So Aloha, pastoral, farming, not very populous, but in the 60s, it starts to develop a little bit. Mm-hmm. You have Tektronix and some of the folks that are living there. You have ESI, you have the development of the spread of various other types of things. But you start having the platting of these houses, these subdivisions, Sydney Woods is more Hills Road, but Cross Creek and some of these things like this. And a whole bunch were platted in the 70s until everything came to a screeching halt. When the economy died in 1980, Richard Fraxon, Glory Problem Board, happened to everything.
Everybody kept calling, every lawyer called every lawyer. Do you have any clients now? Do you have any business now?
Yeah,
I was. As if all the clients decided not to call their lawyers. Yeah.
Exactly. In 1982, I came out of law school, bright-eyed, bushy-haired, that spent the next year, 6 years working off the court appointment list. There was no business here. Who was here in 1980? Raise your hands. Okay. Remember how the streets, like Hillsboro essentially closed down, I mean, boarded up. Portland was a terrible situation. I mean, in many ways, that feels worse than this does now, as far as Oregon went. And it took a long time to get out of it. And in 83, we sort of heckled out of it. I think the state budget, correct me if I'm wrong, because you were, I think the state budget for 81 was, I think, $4.2 billion, general fund budget. And I think it was $3.8 that next biennium. In other words, not only did you take a cut in an increase of government, we actually took a real cut. And then all the deals that we later root for, the PERS thing, the taxation of federal retirees, the 8% guarantee to teachers, all those things, made those deals just to survive. So now Aloha is here. It's tough. In 83, poor Carl George and his friends decide that you've got the
quarter, and you're seeing the accretion of each city. Now, accretion's not really. Yeah, I guess it is. The ocean accretes, land goes down. You see the movement of the large municipalities towards this area, taking all the developable land and all the land that can be developed as any economic value. It's the rule of $1. Essentially, if you get bare land, you put a, basically you put a dollar in, you get $1.20 back from increasing taxes. Like that. That's just a rule of thumb. You get a developed area to redevelop it, cost you a buck, you get 80 cents back. So no one wants that. The way the reason Aloha looks is the way it is right now, with no street lights, no very few sidewalks, 8-foot culverts, and women falling into culverts, being there 3 days, dying of exposure. Some of the stories that we've heard there is because you have now, you have the most compact urban mass that no other municipality wants or will take. Hillsborough doesn't want it. And basically, I think the largest industrial parcel within the general area of what is now, that's very compressed low with 41,000 people, is I think it's 4 acres.
4 acres.
Yeah, so essentially, yeah. Now, Hillsborough, now Aloha had a chance at that time, if they're able to convince the Barbie Commission to allow it to become a city, to prevent the expansion. So what do you think the chances of three older gentlemen who kind of hobby politicked would be against larger entities? Because remember, Intel is over by Intel is at 198th and TV Highway at that time. Mr. Husk came by from down south and set up that plant. And Intel knows it's going to be expanding. You've got Floating Point, all these ancillary things, Lattice, all things out there. What do you think the chances are that they're going to let Aloha set up its own little city?
Mm-hmm.
It ain't happening. No. So basically, every place where there weren't people was acquired. Every place that were was bypassed. So now you have Aloha, and the history of Aloha can be made very simple. I'm up on the hill, I'm in Cooper Mountain, but my kids go to Aloha. I don't let them ride their bikes or walk or anything like this. Aloha, the time you were there, when it was in sort of its era, you could be, basically, I remember Aloha High School was on the dairy. There was no dairy there.
Mm-hmm. I remember when it was being built.
Remember that dairy?
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember, in 1969, I played football in that field. Oh. The thing was there, I went down, you know, as a lineman. I go, ooh, that doesn't smell good. I thought they'd done something to cover it a little deeper in the football field, but they hadn't. So eventually, but Aloha High School, basically, it had its glory years from about 75 to about 85 to about 83.
Yeah.
And they had outstanding students. They had outstanding athletes. Wally Backman played captain of the Nets. You're the one that met the World Series. You had James Rogers, All-American, Nate Sassaman, all kinds of folks were, had some very, a mystery writer who's written for, I mean, a science fiction writer who's written for a number of things. I forgot her name right now, sorry. I can remember it in my notes. But anyway, you had this burgeoning sense of community. But the school district decided to redistrict, and the only part, this is a political map here, everything cut Aloha and bisected Aloha. And Aloha was not a city, so Aloha had no ability, and even the school district boundaries were not Aloha. I happened to be on the school district site selection committee in 1988 with David Chen and some other folks, and we ratified the location of Southridge High School over there in Beaverton. We didn't realize the boundaries of it would have just cut the wealthy area off Aloha. When Westview was built, we didn't think it would cut the wealthy area off that end.
Yeah.
So essentially, you ended up, when you cut Westview and Southridge out of the situation, you cut the demographic, mm-hmm. You almost cut geographic all flat land, all the flat lands in that area there. So Aloha became a victim of a number of different things. One, you had the hyper-density of the houses, of the apartments, and you had a concomitant crime thing since there was no law enforcement to speak of. So started the middle schools. And I'm going to bring this around. A very good friend of mine is Judge is a former presiding judge in Washington County, and I won't use names, but his daughter, sometimes babysit my kids, she went to Mountain View
until he pulled her out of there, sent her down to cathedral, sent his older son down to cathedral because he's so concerned. What had happened is the Hispanic gangs had gotten kind of a foothold at Lowell High School and some of the middle schools. And some of the Asian kids formed their own gangs. Mm-hmm. And Seisei Pathamabang formed the little, gang there. And basically, you had essentially some level of unending gang warfare at Aloha High School and these little areas, which further drove the people out. The judge put his daughter in St. Mary's, unaware of the fact that, which eventually fatal to her, that the meth dealing operation that Pathamabong was running was out of three houses adjacent to the convenience store just south of St. Mary's at Farmington and Murray.
Yeah. Right there behind.
Right there. So basically, she ended up getting killed about 2 or 3 years ago in a rival between them. The school district became aware of certain things. They became aware of the fact they had to change the culture. They had to get the gangs out of there. They had to resurrect. People like myself, who bought houses there, became involved. Some very major people got involved. The title of my talk was From Buck Grocery to the State Championship. And we're going to deal with the last decade relatively quickly. What happened is they put very good principals like Mr. Bede into Hazeldale, cleaned up Hazeldale, which is always an okay school, went into Mountain View, cleaned out a little bit, then went down to the high school, cleaned out a bit. They had a real problem, though, because there's a little thing called Title IX. Aloha had a great men's baseball field, but no girls' softball. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's trying to figure out, how can we do this? So in a very extensive community partnership organized by the athletic director, Mr. Bryant, with the National Guard, all kinds of folks, they created the softball field on that east end. Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous undertaking. It required replumbing 185th. But once they did that, Nike got involved. A bunch of folks put a whole bunch of money at that school, and it went from an underperforming school to one of the top schools academically in the state. It went from a situation where almost every football game, I remember watching them, you just wonder about your boys. The kids at that time, whether they're going to get out safely, not whether they're going to win a game, because they were going to win a game. The coach there went 10-71, one of the worst records of any football coach ever. But that doesn't mean he's a bad coach. Matter of fact, it shows the degree of tenacity that he had, the fact that no one else wanted the job, too. But he stuck it out until they finally couldn't take it anymore, and he had to resign. When Chris Casey got involved as a new football coach, you have basically Nike's involved, they're giving the kids uniforms, they built it to the youth situation. You basically start seeing money in, they rebuilt parts of school, built the stadium, built the lights, and it became actually equivalent to other high schools. Mm-hmm. And academically, athletically, and they came to the point where they are right now. They won a state title. That's a school whose last main title was in. Well, that's the problem. See, if that's true, then what we did for the last decade was for naught.
Yeah.
My son, for people who don't know, is the number one college recruit. He's a junior in the United States. He's one of the fastest big person that's ever stepped on track in the last 30 years.
Amazing.
That doesn't mean that he's not going to get injured and be just another footnote like Marcus Dupree. Who remembers Marcus Dupree? Mm-hmm. Who remembers Marcus Dupree?
I don't know.
What's the story of Marcus Dupree?
Oh.
Oh, Mississippi, most outstanding guy, went to Oklahoma, came to Portland. What happened here in Portland?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Marcus Dupree, Herschel Walker, Bo Jackson, and Marcus Dupree, three of the most amazing human beings ever to step on a track or football field. They're all about 220. They could run 10 flats, 9 900s. In other words, God didn't make people like that. Everybody could run a 9.9 or 9.7, 100 meters, weighs 150 pounds. Everybody weighs 220 pounds, does it. 10-5 or 10-7. They actually had that. So if my son, the owner of the state title, because my son, and all the efforts we've had of developing all these other sports, supporting these things, at least my last story, is for naught. I don't think it's just my son.
No, I'm just saying.
I'm hoping nobody will get your point. If it is.
He's very blessed.
If he is. But yeah. If it's just him, we essentially go back to what we were.
Right.
And basically, I'm hoping that's not true. Mm-hmm. It's going to depend upon the goodwill of the community, whether that happens or not. This is the last part of my story. I have 1 minute left. Coach Casey comes here. He's a college coach, a kinesiology professor, and he knows what you have to get kids strong. The first year he's here, they can't win. It's going to come out of the youth program, but he gets all the high school kids and all the kids lifting weights. But they notice they can't get the gains. They're not getting big. So finally they figure it out. They start checking out. Nutrition. They weren't eating. So essentially, one of the things Loa had to do with the parents is after every practice, all the kids are fed. Regardless of income, they're all fed. With that, you started seeing players getting bigger, linemen getting bigger. Wow. And all of a sudden, you started seeing the offensive lines that could compete. You started holding on to your folks. So essentially, you took a team that was 10-71 since the mid-90s to not to 2004 to the state title within essentially 6 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. However, it's no longer Casey's. Casey said he would never have taken the job if he knew that what awaited him. Like Rick Miller from Avamere had to donate a weight room, a $267,000 weight room, so you got a weight room. Nike and a whole bunch of other people had to contribute to the football field, then all the other sports, the Little League baseball, the girls' softball, because the girls' softball team made it to the semifinals. All these things that happened, the educational things that happened, have flowed directly from that. So now here you have it, you have the conundrum. In 1983, when there was all this land available, because it had not yet been assimilated, because again, there was a terrible recession going on. They had their eyes on it. The Boundary Committee ruled at that time that Loa did not have the wherewithal to support itself as a city. Now, a much constrained Loa has an opportunity. In October of last year, the St. Mary's property, the other St. Mary's property, not the one Tech got, the other one, 209th TV Highway, Rosedale, 229th, came on. Hillsborough has it planned as South Hillsborough. And so basically, that's the deal that Tech made a long time ago. The D1X plant comes on board. By the way, that's a $3.6 billion decision they made mm-hmm. very short period of time. We spent 20 years on a $3.6 billion decision called the bridge over the Columbia, which we can't fund. But they did that quick. And almost every major crane in the metropolitan area of the states, they're working on it. They want a place for the higher end type of folks that are going to come here, the H-1 visa people, the engineers from other places. They want to put them there. They want that area there. They want it a residential with some mixed stuff. If Loa were to acquire that for some type of light industrial or mixed commercial type of thing, that would be the component that could allow Loa to be a viable city. It won't happen. We already lost that battle. But the point of it is, that would be the battle. But right now, you have an issue. If you're going to bring a residential area with your $1.20 next to an area where you put a dollar in, get 80 cents back, what would be the logical concept of combining those two infrastructure from an infrastructural standpoint? You get a wash with no extra taxes. Mm-hmm. So that's the history of Loa. Pastoral farmland, guys, not much really happening. They come, they walk in to take away from Indians who really aren't able to do anything about it because they lost the ability to do so sometime 50 to 80 years earlier. The same people who were on top in Massachusetts were on top in Portland, and they kind of dribbled out to this area. And basically, you have fought a war, which Supreme Commander Eisenhower decided wanted an interstate highway system when he was president. He had to develop the West through the federal largesse interstate highway system. Then you had another war, the Vietnam War, which required a lot of the efforts from here. And people forget, Portland was a major port for that purpose during the Vietnam War. And that's why I knew prior to Richard Nixon telling us that we went to Cambodia, because the guy got off the boat, said, hey, we're in Cambodia. I said, no, we're not. The president said, we're not. He said, no, I was in Cambodia. I said, no, you couldn't have been. Our president would not lie to us. So anyway, that's a history from Buck's post office, the state championship. It's actually a mystery more than anything else. Thank you.
John mentioned just briefly the Willamette Stone State Park, which is over by the Catholic Cemetery. And this actually shows how everything was surveyed off of those points. There is right here what is known as the Willamette Meridian, and it intersects right here with Baseline. You folks about Hillsboro, you heard of Baseline Road?
Yeah.
It's built along the baseline. And so anyway, this shows how they eventually did this, and everything in the state, all these lane sections, are all surveyed off of that connection. There's one other thing about this map, and we won't take time with it now, but if the first person can figure out what the answer is, we'll get at least a free cookie. And this map has also, I know I play this, not really a trick, but I've offered this to several people. It takes a little few minutes to figure it out. But this map has all sorts of major topographical features on there, mountains and rivers and that sort of thing. But one of the most important topographical features of the state of Oregon is not listed on this map. If you can figure that out, you get a free cookie. And if you figure out why it's not listed on the map, you get another free cookie. So I'll leave this over here, and afterwards, you folks may want to come by and take a look at it and see what the reason is for that. Huh? Yeah, you probably already know. Does anybody have any further questions for John?
Oh, that's right. Don't be afraid to be combative, by the way, because this is, as you notice, I didn't have a slideshow. This is opinion and accumulated prejudice on my part.
I was curious if you knew any, because I grew up on Cooper Mountain, starting in 65, and my grandparents had 20 acres up there, which is now big McMansions. But do you know anything, history about Cooper? Like, was it a Robert Cooper, or do you have any history of why it was called Cooper Mountain?
I've heard stories, but I've heard conflicting stories.
Okay.
Because when the folks, you know where Shirley's Bakery is?
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, Shirley's Bakery, since Councils of Music, the law firm that gave their expertise to Tektronix, we're still there. A bunch of lawyers used to have coffee at the Shirley's Coffee House. And that's, you still go there at 10 o'clock, and the descendants of that original coffee shop from the 40s are still there. There they used to tell different versions of how it became Cooper Mountain. And I really just think it was a surveyor's thing.
Just
named it Cooper. And basically there was no, you couldn't grow anything on the thing because the soil was just bad. You could grow hay in parts of it. Some parts couldn't even grow timber.
There was a Cooper family.
There was a Cooper family.
Missouri school, right. It came with a Cooper family.
And they claimed it was named after them, but I don't think it was, because I knew the Coopers too. They claimed the mountain was named after them. Unfortunately, they have a lot of them had an Appalachian Argo, so I think they just got there. Remember that?
Yes.
They got there in the 40s, and it was named Cooper Mountain long before they got there.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea why the Beaverton Hillsboro School District
is so Judy Jaffe?
Well, why it isn't on a major road. Like, it's 196, and that doesn't even go through.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how they got boundaries. I was actually a title officer along with being a locator, and that's why most of the stuff was in the mark and position was 1 north 1, 1 north 2, right there, above the baseline. A lot of the stuff here, you know, when they gave the Asian land claims, they actually cut the sections out geographically by their relationship to Willamette Stone. And a lot of the roads were roads that skirted the outskirts of the farms. And so a lot of the roads that you don't know why they go there that way were that way for a reason. But a lot of times they also cut them short. So the school boundaries were established at a fairly early time. You know, Beaverton High School was built, what, 1905? And Hazeldale Elementary was
because they had their
100
years.
Pardon?
1901.
Yeah, 1901. See, you can't. You go back to 1840. There's not squat here. You know, it's Joe Meek wandering around, you know, hoping they don't use silk hats in Europe and break the beaver industry, which of course they did, which is why you had to settle down and work. But your specific reasons why. Yeah, Esther likes that. He actually didn't want to work. None of those guys, Travis, wanted to work. But when we were interested in collapse, they happy. I believe, my thing is, basically 1966, basically they reorganized the school, the school district in various different ways. And nobody was really thinking about development like this that was going on now. So I think it was compromised almost block by block, by a lot of old farm roads, old donation land claims, old property things. And basically, Richard, were you a Beaverton High School graduate?
No, Jesuit High School.
What year did you graduate from Jesuit?
63.
What relationship did Al Kemper have to Jesuit High School?
Well, I knew Al Kemmer really through my mother, who was raised here in this area, knew Kemmer from that regard, but I don't recall specifically.
They were so scarred by what happened with Sisters of St. Mary's, they wanted to have their own Catholic school. And so they finally got the cash together in location, 1959 was it? 58?
What, for the land? For Jesuit High School? Yeah. Oh, that I did not know. Oh, I did not know that. But that's Jesuit High School had its first graduating class in 1959, which means
50s,
they opened in 58.
Yeah, opened in 58. So basically they've been trying for a long time to open a private school because they were never the trauma of what happened. You know, that wasn't that long ago. If you were born in 1919, you were a young lawyer in 1930s when that thing happened. And so
I have a bit more information.
Sure.
If you want me to tell you,
go ahead.
That. John talked about the Ku Klux Klan. And I had occasion a few years ago to do some research about this. And this is about how the Ku Klux Klan got to Oregon. In the 1840s, the National Democrats controlled politics in Oregon. And the National Democrats were primarily a pro-Southern party, but they were also a pro-immigrant and pro-Catholic party in the North. And the folks who came out to Oregon originally were all appointed by Democratic presidents, because when people like Meek, but also some other people who became the governors and early territorial governors and so forth, when Oregon became a territory, for example, James K. Polk, who was a Democrat, was the president. And he began appointing people. People who were appointed to the territorial Supreme Court, a lot of Democrats. And the Democrats, such as it was, in terms of the number of people in Oregon, which were very few, were primarily the dominant political party. In the 1850s, the Democrats' principal opposition were the Whigs, and the Whigs were a very minor party, so the Democrats were assured of controlling politics there. In the 1850s, people started moving in on the Oregon Trail, who came from the East Coast, who were members of what is known as the Know-Nothing Party. And the Know-Nothing Party were called Know-Nothings because they would go out and they would burn down Catholic churches and Catholic convents, and they had riots, and they were an extraordinarily anti-Catholic party.
And who
they called
that?
Themselves the American
Party. I was Catholic.
When the Know-Nothing Party came out here, they actually settled between Beaverton and Tyler.
Right.
And there's a book that we have here called Washington County. It's about Washington County, our Washington County. It's a very well-known book, has tremendous amounts of information in it. But one of the things the author said is that was the source of the original anti-Catholic feelings were from those people who settled out here, who are not Know-Nothings. And one thing that happened that was also very fascinating in terms of Oregon history is that when the Democrats saw these Know-Nothings coming out here, they were afraid they were going to arm themselves, join up with the Whigs, and they would then dominate politics. And the Democrats were losing. So the Democrats did something which is very fascinating. They established a system of open voting. No secret ballots, open voting, called viva voce voting. And you went to the polls, you stood in front of the clerk, and you said, "Hi, my name is Richard Viteri, and I vote for Abraham Lincoln." And they got right down Abraham Lincoln, and Richard Viteri voted for Abraham Lincoln. And these poll books still exist. They exist in the Salem archives. And you can go down. I saw Judy's family over 2 or 3 elections, how they voted. Luckily they voted for Abraham Lincoln, I know that. But so that system was in place because the Democrats said, well, this will keep the Know-Nothings from voting because the Know-Nothings will not want to be identified as being this terrible group, so we keep them from voting in the elections. And that system lasted in Oregon until the early 1870s. But that's where they...
It's all coming back to us, yeah.
Okay, more questions or about origin now? Yes.
I just want to make a comment about, you know, making dividing school districts. I had an experience back in this in Bloomington, Indiana. This is not Oregon, but it's Bloomington, Indiana. They were going to divide the school, the town, you know, north south. So you think they're going to draw a line like this, right? North, south, right? Right like that. No, 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 no. Oh, good football player.
True. Yes. That's how they do it. That's how they do it.
I remember, I don't know, maybe in the late 40s, into the 50s, driving out west, and it would be like Aloe Huber, Reedville, Tobias.
Tobias,
were those all railroad stops, or what was all that?
Yeah. Actually,
is that what that was?
It was a whistle stop.
But see, the issue was, remember, everyone you go from all the way down to California, from Seattle through Oregon, through that. And so basically the competition was that going to come through Beaverton? Was that going to come through that? Was that going to come through Gaston? How was that going to happen? And so each of these things, you know, we had this, each of these groups, the Gaston, who later collapsed and Korea acquired him, acquired us right away, but what became Southern Pacific, I believe, and you had the ONC, the electric railroad went all the way past here. You had Beaverton was on the Oregon Electric, and the Oregon Electric took you down Beaverton Hills Highway, up to Council Crest and back into Portland. So so you had the big one, the big freight one was where the money was, and that's when Gaston and Cornelius were fighting over. The one that went from Portland out to Forest Grove was ONC Electric. And so you had different things. You had the substations for the Oregon Electric, which was primarily some coverage of crops and things like that, but primarily people going back and forth. Okay. Then the other one was a major commercial one.
Is that how it got the names like Witch Hazel and Hubert? Do you know anything about those?
Street Bill.
Jack's name.
Yeah,
that's Rose different names. That's why you have the multiple different railways.
I see.
Yeah. You know that.
Speaking of the railroad, if anybody's interested, the Union Pacific Railroad is celebrating 150 years. Mm-hmm. August 5th, at Alpine Yard, underneath the Fremont Bridge with a big black smokestack, we're having a picnic. There'll be a train ride, it'll go forward and back, and it's open to the public.
I thought they were going to do that at Cosgrave Kester's law offices. Pacific lawyers. Okay, thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Remember a free cookie if you can figure out the mystery to this man. But you also have to answer why.
I want to get a cookie anyway.
So what are they going to do with the anchorage there?